Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. This week, we have been focusing on some of my favorite conversations of 2024. I have to include what you're about to hear in that list of favorite conversations. The most powerful woman in banking left the building, but she only walked a few blocks north on Tryon Street from the Bank of America, where she worked at the highest levels for 40 years, to the Foundation for the Carolinas, where she became its president and CEO. Of course, I'm talking about Kathy Bessant, whose achievements while at Bank of America not only put her on Barron's list of the 100 most influential women in U.S. finance in 2020 and 2021, but gave her experience in dealing with people from all walks of life around the world and here in Charlotte. As the bank's chief operations and technology officer, she was responsible for a team of 95,000 people in 35 countries. Here in Charlotte, outside the bank, she worked on community development projects and provided guidance which led to positive outcomes for low-income communities. She has been at the tip of the spear when it comes to diversity and inclusion and steered various committees and groups working to prepare the city for tomorrow. All of that, and so much more, was preamble and perfect preparation for what she's doing now, running one of the most successful and largest community foundations in the country, managing more than $4.2 billion in charitable assets for families, nonprofits, and businesses. We could spend the rest of the morning talking about her accomplishments and how they set the stage for this new job and what this new job means to her and for the future of the Foundation for the Carolinas, but we don't have all morning. We only have an hour, so let's get to it in this conversation from earlier this year back in January with Kathy Bessant. Kathy Bessant, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
We clearly have an audience.
We do.
And we're at our WFAE Uptown headquarters. We talk a lot about the Foundation for the Carolinas, and we've had Michael Marsicano on this program, your predecessor, in the past. But many people may not know, who are listening, who are either new to Charlotte or been here forever, they may not know exactly what the Foundation for the Carolinas is or what it does or how it works. Can you give us a thumbnail?
Sure. In fact, often in the last 3 or 4 weeks, as I've been sitting in the chair, I've been surprised at the number of times that I've needed to explain, even to people who've been here a long time, what the foundation is. I think it's easy to look at us and see a beautiful building and lots of artwork and glass and think of us as an edifice or a structure, but really we do three things. We inspire philanthropy through donors who create funds at the foundation, and then have a choice of either directing where those funds go or allowing us to direct those funds. About 95% of our funds are self-directed, meaning the donors direct where that money goes. Our job is to invest it very wisely, give people information and help them achieve their philanthropic goals and objectives, and then make sure that in aggregate that adds up to real community impact. Second thing we do is we do direct work on our own. We would be known for several things around town over the years, but with a great team and with some resources, we do direct philanthropic work ourselves when we believe it will be catalytic. Those are probably the two big things. Other than that, our goals relate to building better communities for the 13 counties that are served by the Foundation for Carolinas. So very important regional mission, and then we want to have leadership across philanthropic sectors all over the country. So a foundation this size with this many great people needs to be a leader, not only in the U.S., but a little bit globally, and we're happy to take that on.
And you've been involved not just this month when you took over as CEO. You've been involved at the top levels because you were chairman of the board, I think, of the foundation for quite a while. Over that time that Michael Marsicano ran this organization, as you said, he increased the amount of money you have under management to $4.2 billion. I guess that's a beneficiary. That is partly due to your being able to attract people who want their philanthropic dollars to be put to work, but also good things happening in the investment world, which helped that over time. But how do you keep that going forward?
Well, I think there are two ways I've begun to think about it. One is in terms of growth, which is what you're asking about. The other is in terms of impact. And so if you were asking me what I think the most important thing for us to tackle is in terms of growth, it is expanding the number of funds that we have. The dollar amounts can fluctuate depending, as you say, on the markets, depending on what our donors choose to give. But expanding the range of people and entities that hold funds at the foundation, I think, is a very good measure of, are we increasing the depth of philanthropy in the community, and are we magnetic to not only donors of today, but donors of the future?
I want to talk a little bit later on about how you attract those dollars to you and those individuals who want to put their philanthropic dollars to work. We'll do that a little bit later on in this conversation. But I want to talk about some of the things that the foundation has done, is doing with that money, with philanthropist money. What kinds of things do you involve that money in?
Well, oftentimes, and just to put a frame on it, the amount of funding that we actually direct as an individual organization, where we have discretion, is relatively speaking under $5 million a year at the foundation level, and roughly around $25 million a year in Mecklenburg County. And so when you think about $4 billion, there's not a lot of discretionary funding, which means we'd like to grow that discretionary funding, then apply great intellect and caring and heart and soul to doing more philanthropic work. We're involved in very visible things that you can see, like the Carolina Theater. We are actively involved in raising funds for and helping to lead the Leading on Opportunity work that is focused on economic mobility. We've been instrumental in the fund development for the mayor's effort on racial equality. The list is pretty long, and for some of you who've been in Charlotte for a long time, you can go all the way back to the beginning of the Carolina Thread Trail to see some of the impact, the catalytic impact that the foundation has been directly involved in. I like to think that while it's easy to look back, it's important to remember that at the point in time when we took those things on, there weren't very many other people that were willing to take them on. So we've tended to step into the breach when either the fundraising is tough, the actual effort is tough, or it's really, really important and yet needs a tremendous amount of community convening. Those are the places we've historically directed our efforts.
I want to talk about something I hadn't planned to talk about at all until you brought it up before we started this conversation on the air, and you just mentioned it in that answer, and that is, what's up with the Carolina Theater? I mean, they built this theater in the 1920s, and they've been refurbing it since 1922. So where does that stand? What is the status of that theater? And for people who don't know, this is an old movie theater, vaudeville house that's on Tryon Street, that I think it hosted Elvis, it hosted vaudeville shows, it hosted The Sound of Music for like 5 years. It was on their screens. And then they closed because a lot of downtown movie theaters closed. Now we're trying to bring it back. So tell me what the status is.
Well, we aren't trying. We will bring it back.
You promise?
I promise. And actually, we're well
getting
on track.
Older in my lifetime.
Yeah, hopefully. No. You know, Hugh McCall's in our audience today. And
he's thrilling me with his eyes right now.
Of course. But Mr. McCall and Harvey Gant and I, 8 years ago, walked the theater before any renovation began under the leadership of Michael Marsicano. And we all looked at each other and said, this will be by far the most complicated renovation any of us had ever seen. Again, it was a project where there had been spiritual convening, Friends of the Carolina Theater, for decades, really. And it was time for action or inaction, and the foundation made the determination that we could uniquely take it on. The city and the county were our partners right from the start. So the city, if everyone remembers all the news and press, the city sold it to the foundation for a dollar. It was overpriced at the time. And what it is designed, first of all, it is going to be one of the finest theater renovations that has ever happened. And believe me, I've spent 2.5 years in living in Europe, I've seen a lot of fine renovation. So this is going to be an incredibly special place. It will, yes, do entertainment convening, but it will do civic convening and find places for civic and educational discourse, a way to live our goal of living in equality and equity and creating a physical place where those things can happen. So the vision of 8 years ago, and for the Friends of the Carolina Theater 25 years ago, 30 years ago, that vision is real. Mm-hmm. It is very, very complicated. The restoration work has had us bring in literally the finest restoration professionals in the country, some would argue in the world. We are highly desirous of being state-of-the-art from a technology perspective, so retrofitting a building from the 1920s into more than modern day, but something that will be modern day for the next 10 to 15 years. It takes incredible brain power and an incredible fortitude. So really worthwhile and special mission. Yes, it will be done. And it is a project that is well worth the effort that's been put into it.
So most people who work for a company for 40 years, as you did with Bank of America, would look at that and say, well, if it's 40 years and it's time for me to retire, I'm going to retire. But not you. You jumped out of the frying pan and into the fire to run one of the most successful community funds in the country. Why? Why did you want to take this on at this time in your life?
Well, anyone who's met me knows I over-index to energy. maybe over-indexed to intensity a little bit. I think more than anything, my family was worried that I would turn all that energy and intensity on them. So there is no one more happy to have me in this role. But I was complete at the bank, no question about it. I was not complete in my belief that as human beings and citizens, we have a role to make communities better. And what better than one of the finest community foundations in the country, well-run, but yet a lot of opportunity for growth and impact. And for me, I feel like, I hope everyone feels like at some point in their lives, this is a dream job for me.
And when you decided to retire, was this job on the horizon or did it just come out of the ether for you? Because I have 20 seconds.
It did not come out of the ether. I made the decision to retire first. And then once that was completely decided, I knew the board search was going on. I called Arrington directly, and the rest is history.
Kathy Bessant is our guest. She is the new president and CEO of the Foundation for the Carolinas. We have a lot to talk about her interesting life and plans for the future as well when we come back.
We're listening back to one of my favorite conversations of 2024 with Kathy Bessant, who transitioned after 40 years with Bank of America to run the Foundation for the Carolinas, one of the preeminent philanthropic organizations in the country. We have a lot more to talk about, and we'll hear that coming up in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today at our WFAE Uptown headquarters is Kathy Bessant. She is the new CEO and president of the Foundation for the Carolinas after 40 years at Bank of America, where she did a lot of things.
for this city and to this city, and we'll talk about that as well as we go through this program. She literally walked out of the door after 40 years at Bank of America and into the Foundation for the Carolinas. Not a day off, it seems to me, which is amazing. Let's talk about philanthropy for a second, because there are cities in this country where major industrialists have played a serious role in making those cities special. Pittsburgh comes to mind. I don't know that we have people with pockets that are that deep in this. Maybe we do. You can tell me if we do. But are we in that category, or is Charlotte different?
Well, I think Charlotte and maybe some parts of the South overall are different. If you think about industrialist money, or early stage financial institution and banking money, you would think about the North and the Northeast. You would think about Pittsburgh. You'd think about Cleveland. You'd think about some of the famous names in family philanthropy. And I think the difference is those foundations that are a result of that are almost fully funded with deep endowments, meaning the application of the industrialist money a long time ago, mm-hmm. with the purpose of the body of that or the corpus of that never being touched. And so those foundations can fully fund what they want to fund with the income from those long-standing industrial heavy money-based funds. Here in the South, we have a tremendous amount of resources and very generous and large-scale philanthropists, but there's no question that it's different. It's more current generation. It's more based on a services industry or agricultural industry, the other ways that we've grown up, where it's less capital intensive and more current income intensive, and hence endowments that will build over time. But that move to being more less self-directed over time and more community philanthropy driven is one that our region needs to continue to tackle. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it's sort of a geeky explanation.
So we live in this world now where we have, many people have lost their sense of civic responsibility. We're in it for ourselves. I got mine, you go ahead and get yours, but too bad for you if you don't. And the whole idea behind philanthropy, it seems to me, is to put your money to use for the common good. If you have that extra money or you want to invest that extra money, how difficult is that to encourage people to do in the current environment?
I don't believe it's actually more difficult. I believe it's very different. New age, new generation philanthropy looks different than the philanthropy of the industrialists in terms of the way people want to be involved and the causes that are important. The way we raise money is very different. 10 years ago, who knew what GoFundMe was? And yet, the retail and technology-driven aspects of philanthropy are very different. And I like to think of that those things give us opportunity, not challenge. I think this is fair. I have never seen a situation where the case is compelling for the greater good that people don't step up. Mm. And I don't like the word never. I don't believe in it. But I've never seen a situation where the combination of a great idea, an important idea for impact, and resources don't come together. I'm very much an optimist on this topic, but I do believe philanthropy of today and tomorrow is very different than how we got here.
Philanthropy is a big word and a bigger idea. A lot of people make charitable donations, write a check to the American Cancer Society so you can take it off your taxes at the end of the year. This is different. So I'm curious, can the average person participate with the Foundation for the Carolinas as an investor, or do you have to be rich?
You do not have to be rich. In fact, the bulk of our resources come from a very distributed fund holder base, roughly speaking about 3,000 fund holders. Mm-hmm. And some of the vast majority of those are personal, a few are corporate. Some are institutional. We hold money for other entities, for 600 not-for-profits here in this region. And so the donor base is very diversified. And we work every day to bring down the minimum level of investment We're thinking a lot about how to create opportunities when there's a minimum that makes sense for groups and individuals coming together to make those minimums. So you do not have to be rich. We see funds of all sizes. We also take, believe it or not, what I would call, as a nerd, I'd call it illiquid assets, but actual physical assets. A long time ago, when Dale Earnhardt Sr. passed away, we received unbelievable physical assets, including the bumper of one of his race cars. You know, and I don't use that as a representative example. We don't have a lot of bumpers sitting around at the foundation. But we know how to take cash and other liquid assets, but also creative assets, and make them have a charitable, I like the word better actually, but okay, charitable impact, the way people hope they would be, but don't have any idea how to convert that bumper into something meaningful.
So let's talk about how this works.
Don't send me any more bumpers.
I have a spare tire that you can. Talk to me about how this works. Is it comparable to somebody who wants to start investing, and so you hire a financial planner who helps figure out where to put your money for the best return for you in your circumstances? Is it like that? People come to you to say, I have this money that I'd like to put toward charitable works. Help me figure it out. Is that what happens?
It happens every day. The alternative also happens, where we know of certain moments where people or organizations may have capacity to invest for charitable purposes, and so we will actively reach out to potential donors and grow our fund base and their fund base that way too. So it has to work in both directions, but it happens in funny ways. I was walking to my new parking spot. I hate to say that one of the most complicated things I've faced is to figure out my new parking garage after literally almost 30 years of parking in the same place. But setting that aside, this turned out to be very fortuitous because someone that I knew came and said, and I was thrilled to see her. I had no idea what she was going to say to me. And she said, I won the lottery. And my financial advisor told me I need to open a fund at the Foundation for the Carolinas.
Hmm.
So in that case, we have financial professionals with people with moments where they've come into some money, want to do something good that will connect us. There are times people know of us, and then there are times we I don't like the word market, but let's just say we actively work to develop that relationship ourselves.
So I was going to ask you why someone would choose the Foundation for the Carolinas to do this for them as opposed to just doing it themselves or doing it to individual charities. And then I ran across this quote from your predecessor, Michael Marsicano, who wrote in a publication called Philanthropy Journal, "When donors give in isolation, they often limit their donations to universities, churches, and larger charities because those larger charities and institutions have dedicated fundraisers to approach people and ask for their money. It's foundations like yours that come and ask donors on behalf of smaller companies, small ballet companies, small nonprofits, for monies that then help lift a lot of boats at the same time. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely. A fair bit of what we do has to do with education. So when we have a new donor that either we've helped discover or they've discovered and come to us, we spend quite a bit of time finding out what are their interests, what would enable them to feel great about the impact that they were having with the donations that they're prepared to make. And then it's our job to match potential recipients with donors to widen the pool of organizations people know about, and therefore ensure that not just the big names, not the names that everybody knows, but names that need to be a part of the philanthropic discussion and community, but don't often get easy or aren't well known out there.
And we should remind people that this is called the Foundation for the Carolinas.
Yes.
It is not the Foundation for Charlotte. And you serve 13 counties in both states, North and South Carolina.
We do.
What do you see as this region's greatest need or needs right now?
Well, I think in the macro sense, I would, first of all, It's a great region. Let's just start there. I've lived all over the world. No kidding. And the, one of the many reasons I'm proud to call this city and this region my home is because it is special here. The way that we think about ourselves, the way that we're willing to name a sports asset for a region and not necessarily just for a city, those things don't happen everywhere. I used to live in Tampa. I talk all the time about how people in Tampa and St. Petersburg think they are on different planets. And yet they're right next door. And I think we as a region work really hard for that not to happen.
Florida is a different planet.
Well, I enjoyed it too. I did. They tore my house down after I left. I don't know what that says about anything. But I think one of the biggest challenges we face is behaving as a region, and really understanding that as much as I don't like the cliche, a rising tide does serve all boats. When we have a headquarters relocate to our region, it's good for all of us. When we have Discovery Place here in Charlotte, and then we have Discovery Place in Rockingham, that strengthens the breadth of the impact, and both of those organizations are stronger from being part of the same region. So ensuring the regional dialogue is persistent and that we use it to leverage our outcomes and impact, I think, is very important. We have all of the challenges that other regions face. There's often a big perception of a dichotomy between a metropolitan focus and a more regional. More regional focus or more rural focus in some of the cases of our state and South Carolina as well. I think really overcoming the diversity of need and impact and perspective that happens in the larger cities and the smaller communities. Transportation is a very big issue. How we think about education regionally, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity there. And so, but I will say what I have seen, and I've spent time with regional representatives from all 13 counties at this point, what I have seen is a great spirit for those things to happen. There is no shortage of will to operate as a region and to leverage the very best of who we are as a region. Someone like the Foundation for the Carolinas or an entity like the Foundation, we have a role to play in helping create the paths for that energy. 20 years ago, the Carolina Thread Trail is a good example, and we just need to ensure that that's a role that we play and that we leverage the will.
Okay, that's the good news. We've done the warm-up now. Now we get to focus on you. Kathy Bessant is our guest, and we're going to talk about you now and what you've accomplished over the years, both in and out of your world as a banker and as now the head of this Foundation for the Carolinas. You did not set out to do any of this, as I understand it. You set out to be a lawyer. What happened?
I did set out to be a lawyer, and I came to what was a bank in Texas that ultimately Mr. McCall purchased, that became part of the growth of an international franchise for Bank of America. But I came to work for 2 years and make enough money, which I did not have, to go to law school. At that time, when my grandfather passed away, I could not afford bus fare to go home for his funeral. And so while I was fully and heavily directed toward the law school path, I also needed to make that make sense economically. And then I got to the bank. And what I found immediately was that I loved it. And a lot of what I love about it applies in this work we're doing together now, which is I loved finding clients with needs and developing solutions. I loved doing things or applying intellect and creativity in ways that I thought made the company and its mission really special.
Yeah, you didn't just want to be a lawyer. You wanted to be a very specific kind of lawyer, a lawyer for the ACLU. And you spent a lot of your pro bono time, if that's the right word, as a banker, working to make people's lives better, to give them a shot. Is that how you see your job now as head of the foundation?
One of the reasons I wanted to be a lawyer for public service was, and my father used to say this to me all the time, I was a classic, what he would call a jailhouse lawyer. If there was a cause, I was going to find it. If there was an underdog, I was going to champion them. It is, I don't know how to explain that. Both of my parents were in public service and in various ways, and I think it's part of my DNA, but I always am for the underdog. Now, so no surprise that if I was thinking about law or thinking about the nobility of banking, I would think about how we could use commerce and capitalism to benefit those most in need or the underdog or parts of our cities and communities that desperately needed economic vitality. So no surprise there. Now, at the foundation, that is part of the mission. That's what philanthropy is all about, to ensure that those with means ensure that the entire community benefits. That's really the mission. Our job is to make the communities that we serve and work in better places. It is not, it is though now 40 years later, 42 years later, with a recognition that good capitalism and good business and a well-run organization, mm-hmm. like a foundation with tremendous resources under management, can in fact exist and not be an antithesis or a juxtaposition to doing good, but in fact, that is an and. You know, strong institutions and community growth, strong institutions and neighborhood development. They don't exist in opposition to each other. They coexist, I believe.
I have about a minute left in this segment. And you happen to work at Bank of America, which was run by a visionary whose vision was not just to make this the biggest bank in America, but to do things within Charlotte to make Charlotte what it is today. And that has largely been accomplished. But part of that was letting people like you, maybe there were others like you, I don't know, go out into the community and put their fingers on things to improve things. Is that what kept you in banking for 40 years
there? It is. It is the absolute belief that I could accomplish more in the private sector in terms of community impact than I could anywhere else. And I looked at, over time, maybe once or twice, looked at other entities. So yes, that is absolutely what this is all about.
So much more to talk about, including I want to pick your brain on your outlook for this country. Oh boy, howdy. That's coming up when we come back to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Kathy Besson, spent 40 years at the Bank of America, where Hugh McCall called her one of the most important executives that bank had in 30 years. She is now the president and CEO of Foundation for the Carolinas. You ended up, and we were talking about this before the break, that at a bank that, as you just told me off the air, not only allowed you to, but expected you and others to run programs and expand opportunities within the community. You ran a community development bank. You lent money and invested in people who were small and minority-owned businesses who needed the help, to being an executive sponsor of the bank's LGBTQ+ executive council, and that just scratches the surface. You didn't push the bank to do some of these things, because I read a quote about somebody who said, "We want you out in the community because people don't like you here; they like you out there." So, did you push the bank? Did they push you?
Well, that wasn't exactly what he said. Truthfully, though, in that example, what my then boss said to me is, what makes people successful in the community makes them successful at business. And we want you out there so that you learn skills that actually apply in world-class leadership organizations. That was really the point, and I've always found that to be true. The expectation was set for us that effective leaders or effective bankers or business people had to matter, and that was the word that we used. That's the word our CEO, Mr. McCall, coined. And we were taught we must matter and that we'd be evaluated and promoted in part on how we could translate what we were doing inside the company into outside impact, and as the first comment was made, reverse right back in.
Is that the way in most cities, in most big organizations like Bank of America, or is that the exception to the rule?
Any organization that's worth working for, that is the rule.
Okay. You are obviously competitive, and you told American Banker that you were in high school when Title IX resulted in the establishment of girls' sports athletics, and you were on the swim team. I think you were captain of the swim team at that time. You don't rise through the ranks of people in an organization the size of the Bank of America without being competitive. So I'm curious where that streak comes from in you.
I think that, first of all, I think partly it comes from being an optimist. I'm a classic optimist. I always believe that today can be better or that than yesterday, and that tomorrow will be better than today, no matter if they're the best day in the world. And so competitiveness is a part of that, you know, setting goals, meeting goals, working hard in preparation for that moment on the field or in the pool. And so I think it's a natural part of the things that were important to me. And then truthfully, you know, growing up in a very small town, it was something to do, to be competitive, to be part of teams and things like that. And so really formed the foundation of what I think is important about how people succeed and how people have impact, which is the willingness to work to win.
And I could have the timeline wrong, but it seems to me that if you've been in banking for 40 years, you came into the industry about the time when women were pretty much tellers. There weren't many women in upper management, and you moved yourself right to the very top. Well, almost the very top. Close enough to the top. How? How did you do that?
I have believed from the start that there is no substitute for hard work and performance. And so I did what others who came into banking, like Arrington Mixon and I, who joined the bank at the same time, mm-hmm. in the same year, I did what I believe is the fundamental for all performance in any organization, and that is just flat perform. And then from there, take both successes and failings to learn how to be a leader, because there is at some point in any organization, large or small, where success is not based on what you do individually, but based on what you cause a team to do, or how you're a part of a team, and that is a completely different skill set. So over time, went from functional skills to management skills and just a flat failure to do anything but succeed. I think all successful leaders also believe that success is not a pie that can be cut up and divided. Success means the pie gets bigger for everyone. Mm. And so competitiveness and spirit to win are not mutually exclusive with great teamwork, and I think that's important too.
One of the many functions that you served, I'm told, at Bank of America was you were a fixer for the bank. You went to troubled divisions and fixed them, repaired them, made them work again. This country is more divided than it has ever been, perhaps since the Civil War. We have a lot of problems that need to be fixed, and we can't seem to do it. And a part of it is this great divide between the haves and the have-nots. And here you are running a foundation of haves that puts the money to work for the have-nots. So between that experience and what you did at the bank in fixing things, do you think this country can be fixed?
Again, I'm an optimist, and I'm a strong believer in democracy. And while democracy may not always be perfect, it is the very best model ever seen for governing. And it will not only survive, but succeed. I saw someone put on television this morning a shirt up that said, he had made it himself, that said, enough. And when he was asked what that shirt meant, he said, enough. Enough of the vitriol, enough of the rhetoric, enough of the idea that it is a zero-sum game. And that stuck with me. It's going to stick with me long before or long after this conversation. Because fundamentally what it takes to fix something in a business organization or to take on a tough problem in the community is I think what's key to the national dialogue now, which is, again, second use of the word never. I promise never to use the word never twice in one conversation. But I've never seen a situation or a challenge or an issue or a divisive discussion where the people in the setting don't believe in the same things for at least 85, sometimes 90, sometimes 80% of what it is they're debating. That's the same thing with fixing an organizational issue. Find the areas of common ground and leverage them to either make the areas of division less important or to find ways to talk about and discuss how to make change.
One of the things outside of economics that is creating this divide is the changing demographics of the country. We're going to be a majority-minority country, I think, by 2050, and that scares a lot of people. You led the Bank of America's efforts on inclusion and diversity. As I mentioned before, you were the executive sponsor of the bank's LGBTQ+ executive council. It's in charge of its global ally program. And that's just one example of diversity inclusion. What would you say to people who are scared about this?
I would say there have been times in my life when I've been scared too. And I believe that overcoming fear requires A, the understanding that it's there and it's natural, but B, there's no better substitute than education and experience to overcome fear. And so the real essence of what I believe is important is that we have to understand as humans, as citizens, business people, whatever, we have to understand that we are obligated to learn. And in many cultures that have well predated what we have in the U.S. today, they've had to figure that out over not just generations, but centuries. So it may not be an overnight thing, but it is absolutely fundamental. And I don't think it's okay to say we're afraid without saying, but we will learn and have experiences to overcome that fear.
We also live in a country where the concept of justice and social justice mean very different things. And you told Axios Charlotte that you built your career on racial equality, on economic equality, and on social justice, and that you would be working hard after retirement, which has not yet occurred, to take that forward. Why are those ideas so difficult, do you think, for people to understand and buy into?
Well, you know, earlier when you asked me about why the foundation and why now, one of the four or five top tenets at the Foundation for the Carolinas is to live and lead with equality. So again, because that's been a hallmark of what I've believed in as a leader and as a person, it is a natural fit for me. So just to tag back to that conversation for a second, I don't know that I know why it's hard. I could give you a number of theories. I'm not the segment of person that makes it hard. I'm the segment of person that understands it's hard and goes for a solution. So I think it's fear. I think it's the sense of a zero-sum game. I think that it is a distrust of institutions that can help build understanding and that have traditionally been institutions that we've leaned on, but that we have to find a way back to or a way to change some of our large institutions so that they continue to drive the way they once did. I think it's multifaceted, but I don't believe it takes outsized intellect to figure it out. I think it takes hard work and commitment. And I really do believe what Margaret Mead said, and I'll get the quote wrong, but it's on my desk. You know, never forget that a small group of thoughtful people can change the world. Hmm.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about something that some people fear and others embrace, and no matter whether you fear or embrace it, it's running the world, and that is technology. One area that you concentrated on while you were at the bank was technology, and you served on the White House President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, a field traditionally run by men. Why were you ahead of the curve? Is this a personal interest? First of all, is this a personal interest, technology of yours?
It was never a personal interest. Never. But it was one of those situations where I was asked to take on a big, important role that was newly created. Blank sheet of paper, effectively. Okay, so challenge, opportunity. Nobody's done it before in the company. That's the perfect kind of role for me, or at least was at that point in my career. And it required a learning curve. And, you know, at that point, been in the bank for 30-plus years, learning curve is a very good thing. I've got a huge learning curve right now, and it's part of what brings me energy. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful for that. Technology, like all important tools, is two things. It's often used to be mystical. People think technology is hard, AI is a concept, big data is a concept. These things are mystifying. And yet it's really about computer programs and data and using technology to make things better, faster, cheaper, more effective. I'm a big believer that important tools can either be forces for good or forces for division. And one of the reasons it was important to me to take on the technology role was to make sure that technology was a force for unity.
You've also been ahead of the curve on artificial intelligence, which we are told will be everywhere very quickly if it isn't already, and that scares a lot of people too. You worked with Harvard University in 2018 to create a council on the responsible use of artificial intelligence to bring academia and business together on the ethical questions that surround artificial intelligence. Give me a question. What is one of those questions?
I think one of those questions is, how do legal systems and the systems that are designed to bring justice ensure that these incredibly powerful tools are delivered justly? Let me give you an example, a small example, and I'll be quick. Say someone writes a program for your driverless car, and that program has either a flaw in it or does not understand that if you grew up in the state of Michigan and you see a deer in the middle of the road, you are taught to hit the deer. Because anything that you might do, swerve, skid on the snow, anything you might do has the potential to be far worse. But say my model is run by someone who grew up in Charlotte that doesn't understand snow. And yet, if a cataclysmic action happens, whose fault is that? How do our systems of accountability and our systems to ensure justice and quality, how do we align to the users of technology that don't update their applications, the writers that may not understand the power of their code, the data that might be great and perfect or wrong going into the model? And so it's really, from my perspective, the responsible element to ensure that society is prepared for the power of the tool.
So we have 2 minutes left. We're going to hit these really quickly.
Okay.
Are you ready?
No, but yes.
Okay.
Quick and me are
because
not.
This surprised me, and it may surprise some folks if I have this right. You are the chairperson of the board of the board of directors of USA Field Hockey.
Go USA, yes.
How is that possible?
Well, my children were involved in field hockey. I did not ever anticipate a leadership role, but for those of you who don't know, now out at UNC Charlotte, we have the U.S. Performance Center, 15 Olympic sports, including the first one to sign up, which is USA Field Hockey. Our USA women did the unexpected and qualified for Paris.
Oh. You also served as Bank of America's president of global corporate banking. You lived in Paris for 2 years. As vice chair of global strategy. What prepared you for that, and do you speak French?
I do not speak French. I took French for now almost 3 years. I'm going to get back to it as soon as I get a little bit of dust settling around me, which may never happen. But it was time to put someone on the leadership team outside of the United States for a bank that wants to be global, but might not always naturally be global. So experience at the top of the house with being outside of our traditional stronghold, I think has been really important to the team. And it was a great experience, great learning curve for me.
So 2 years in Paris, and I'm going to close with this question. Is it true that the reason you came back to Charlotte after you retired is because you wanted to return to a world-class city?
It is. And I wanted to return to a world-class city where I could speak the language. And where I No, and we're in part of a fabric like this. Look at all of these people here. This is an incredible fabric. It doesn't happen everywhere.
Kathy Bisson is the new president and CEO of Foundation for the Carolinas. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.